Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, April 25th through Saturday, the 27th, feature guest conductor Giancarlo Guerrero and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with leader and trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. The varied program includes a foxtrot for orchestra, The Chairman Dances by John Adams, Suite for Variety Orchestra No. 1 by Dmitri Shostakovich, and after intermission, the orchestra joined by the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis in works by Duke Ellington, selections from Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet, and All-American Pep from Wynton Marsalis' own Swing Symphony. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on John Adams' The Chairman Dances, a foxtrot for orchestra lasting about 12 minutes. Today, it doesn't seem unlikely that a composer with a presidential name as John Adams would write an opera about Richard Nixon. But in 1987, Nixon in China was a shocker, a boldly colored minimalist opera about a recent U.S. president and a controversial living figure. It earned Adams a sure place in operatic history and jump-started his career. Early on, Adams was attracted to the stripped-down purity of the minimalist landmarks. He became a convert in 1974 when he heard Steve Reich and musicians perform Reich's Drumming, 90 minutes of musings on a single 12-beat rhythmic pattern. A generation younger than Reich and Philip Glass, the composers most identified with the movement, Adams quickly began to move beyond pure minimalism. His own works borrowed the repetitive language and insistent primary color harmonies, but almost from the start, Adams was trying to say more complicated things. He once said famously, "I'm a minimalist who is bored with minimalism." Adams is one of the few composers who have made the transition from minimalism to an individual, not easy to categorize style. In an early composition like the softly undulating Shaker Loops for strings from 1978, Adams used what he found most appealing in the minimalist vocabulary, a sure and fleet sense of pulsation, generously unfolding fields of harmony and timbre, and gradually evolving musical architectures. But the characteristic shimmering woodwind figures and rippling piano arpeggios of grand pianola music, a major score composed in 1982, are merely the backdrop for a big romantic tune, Beethovenian cadences, gospel harmonies, Valhalla brass banging drums, and a bracing shot of over-the-top vulgarity. Even though Adams quickly tired of minimalism, he still said that it was the only really interesting, important stylistic development of the late 20th century. As much as people would like to deny it, it is responsible for a revolution in music. One night in 1982 at a performance of Shaker Loops, Adams met the director Peter Sellers, who had just finished reading Nixon's memoirs, and the idea for Nixon in China was born. The opera opened in 1987, and although it divided the critics, it immediately struck a nerve with the public. Nixon in China drew a great deal of attention, partly because its main characters were famous living people. It covers Nixon's three-day visit to Beijing in February 1972, and it left an indelible impression. Nixon in China has since played to sold-out houses around the world, although Nixon himself never did see it, making Adams a celebrity, a condition for which he, like most composers, was quite unprepared. At the time, he was featured in People magazine alongside Dolly Parton and Indira Gandhi. Adams' subsequent work has enriched the minimalist vocabulary almost beyond recognition, although traces of its hallmarks continue to make appearances in his scores. But Nixon in China is still his watershed score and one of the few landmarks in music from the last decades of the 20th century. And here is John Adams himself on The Chairman Dances. The Chairman Dances was an outtake of Act 3 of Nixon in China, neither an excerpt nor a fantasy on themes from. It was, in fact, a kind of warm-up for embarking on the creation of the full opera. At the time, 1985, I was obliged to fulfill a long-delayed commission for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, but having already seen the scenario to Act 3 of Nixon in China, I couldn't wait to begin work on that piece. And so, the Chairman Dances began as a foxtrot for Chairman Mao and his bride, Chang Cheng, the fabled Madame Mao, firebrand, revolutionary executioner, architect of China's calamitous cultural revolution, and, a fact not universally realized, a former Shanghai movie actress. In the surreal final scene of the opera, she interrupts the tired formalities of a state banquet, disrupts the slow-moving protocol, and invites the chairman, who is present only as a gigantic 40-foot portrait on the wall, to come down, old man, and dance. The music takes full cognizance of her past as a movie actress. Themes, sometimes slinky and sentimental, at other times bravura and bounding, ride above in bustling fabric of energized motifs. Some of these themes make a dreamy reappearance in Act 3 of the actual opera, En Revenant, returning as both the Nixons and Maos reminisce over their distant pasts. A scenario by Peter Sellers and Alice Goodman, somewhat altered from the final one in Nixon in China, is as follows. Chiang Cheng, a.k.a. Madame Mao, has gatecrashed the presidential banquet. She is first seen standing where she is most in the way of the waiters. After a few minutes, she brings out a box of paper lanterns and hangs them around the hall, then strips down to a chongchang, skin tight from neck to ankle and slit up the hip. She signals the orchestra to play and begins dancing by herself. Mao is becoming excited. He steps down from his portrait on the wall, and they begin to foxtrot together. They are back in Yan'an, dancing to the gramophone. Words by John Adams and program notes by Philip Huscher on John Adams' The Chairman Dances. And now on to selections from Prokofiev's ballet score Romeo and Juliet, the selections lasting about 33 minutes. During Sergei Prokofiev's last trip to Chicago in January 1937, he led the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in selections from his new, still-unstaged ballet, Romeo and Juliet. This was the composer's fifth visit to Chicago, and he clearly felt at home. Shortly after he arrived in town, he sat down with a Tribune reporter and talked freely while eating apple pie at a downtown luncheonette. He was staying in the same hotel room where he had lived for several months during his Chicago visit in 1921 when he presided over preparations for the world premiere of his opera, The Love for Three Oranges. He told the Tribune that his Romeo and Juliet featured the kind of new melodic line that he thought would prove to be the salvation of modern music, one, he said, that would have immediate appeal yet sound like nothing written before. Of all the moderns, the Herald Examiner critic wrote after hearing Romeo and Juliet later that week, this tall and boyish Russian has the most definite gift of melody, the most authentic contrapuntal technique, and displays the subtlest and most imaginative use of dissonance. Chicago was the first American city to hear music from Romeo and Juliet following recent performances in Moscow and Paris, and not for the only time in Prokofiev's career, orchestral excerpts were premiered before the ballet itself had been staged. The idea for a ballet version of Shakespeare's play came from the director Sergei Radlov, who was a friend of Prokofiev and had mounted the first Russian production of The Love for Three Oranges. He and Prokofiev worked together to flesh out a scenario early in 1935, and the composer began to write the music that summer. But the Kirov Ballet, which had commissioned the work, unexpectedly backed out, and the Bolshoi Theater took over the project. There were further problems with the score itself, including Prokofiev's initial insistence on a happy ending. Living people can dance, he later wrote in defense of his decision, but the dead cannot dance lying down. The end was ultimately changed to match Shakespeare's, but then the Bolshoi staff pronounced Prokofiev's music unsuitable to dance and dropped out as well. The premiere of Romeo and Juliet eventually was given in Brno, Czechoslovakia, without Prokofiev's participation. He didn't attend the opening in December 1938, and the ballet wasn't staged in Russia until January 1940. In the meantime, Prokofiev made two orchestral suites of 7 excerpts each, and it was the first of these that he conducted in Chicago. Although no other play by Shakespeare has inspired as many musical treatments as Romeo and Juliet, including more than 20 operas, Gounod's, which the teenage Prokofiev saw in St. Petersburg, is the most enduring, Prokofiev's is the first large-scale ballet. It's one of his most important works, merging the primitive style of his radical earlier music, a newfound classicism, and the sumptuous lyricism of which he was so proud. This week's excerpts, played alternately by the Chicago Symphony and Jazz at Lincoln Center orchestras, begin with music depicting the warring families of the Montagues and the Capulets. From the powerful opening chords to the familiar marching theme, the tone is one of sorrow and inevitable tragedy, offset by Juliet's lovely dance with Paris as its centerpiece, the moment Romeo catches his first glimpse of the girl who will quickly steal his heart. From there, we have a number of character pieces, including a portrait of Juliet as a young girl, and music from the masked ball in the Capulet's ballroom, as well as Romeo and Juliet's celebrated passionate balcony scene. We conclude with the great cinematic scene that cuts from the high bravado duel between Tybalt and Mercutio to the subsequent encounter between Romeo and Tybalt, who fight wildly to the death, ending with a grand funeral procession. Program notes by Philip Huscher on excerpts from Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev. And now on to All American Pep from the Swing Symphony by Wynton Marsalis. The music lasts about 11 minutes. Wynton Marsalis knows perhaps better than anyone how the worlds of jazz and so-called classical music have lived side by side and influenced each other over the years. As signposts, he points to Paul Whiteman's 1924 Aeolian Hall concert when Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue was given its premiere, and Benny Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. Both, Marsalis writes, include a sequence of pieces representing the band leader's understandings of the history of jazz from its beginnings to that date. Duke Ellington's 1943 Carnegie Hall concert, which featured the premiere of his landmark Black, Brown, and Beige, marked a turning point. It told a tonal history of Afro-American music, from work songs to blues to modern swing, including the Afro-Latin tradition, while also presenting Duke's concept of the social advancement of American Negroes from slavery to the early 1940s. Marsalis's own output picks up the story from there with his oratorio, Blood on the Fields, which won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize for Music, and All Rise, his Symphony No. 1 of 1999, which was followed by Swing Symphony and The Jungle. Swing Symphony focuses on Afro and Anglo-American music, as Marsalis says. It also uses harmonic progressions from some of the most successful songs in jazz and popular music to create a unique conception of form as history. The piece embraces the tradition of integrating jazz with symphonic orchestras, from the concert hall to the Broadway stage. It traces the evolution of the swing rhythm from ragtime to this very moment in order to unite diverse instrumental techniques, musical personalities, song forms, dance grooves, and historic eras. And here is Wynton Marsalis himself on All American Pep. The drum set is the embodiment of American practicality, ingenuity, and sass. You only have to pay one person to do 5 things, and the 4 limbs plus all of them together equals 5. Here, I apply the progression and rhythm of the song Charleston. That rhythm is syncopated in many different ways, and both Jason, our jazz drummer, and the orchestra's percussion section play trick or junk drums, using everything but the kitchen sink. A transition with rhythm breaks takes us into a slow Argentinian tango based on the progression of popular song El Día Que Me Quieras. Tango has a fantastic string orchestra tradition, and there are many natural and easy connections with jazz. The habanera, bass ostinato, and straight 4/4 time are a couple of fundamentals tango shares with New Orleans jazz. This section makes use of sweet romantic violins with contrapuntal underpinnings and internal voice leadings that I always loved hearing my father play on the piano. It transitions through the singing trombone a la Tommy Dorsey and goes into a big, upbeat final section, an optimistic, post-depression, happy days are here again mood fit for Broadway. There's the 76 trombones raucousness of our two juxtaposed trombone sections, the powerful French horns and the woodwinds dancing all around up high. It is inspired by Leroy Anderson's Sleigh Ride, another great piece that had probably been played by everyone on the stage and has been heard at every high school band Christmas concert that has ever been played in America. Words by Wynton Marsalis and program notes by Philip Pusher on All-American Pep from Marsalis's Swing Symphony. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.